in the last couple of years. He's got a message. And let me tell you, any person in here that's sober one day by God's grace has a message, and I want to hear. But this man has a message, and we're in for a treat. And I'm not going to take up any more of his time. Help me give a big welcome to BOS from Roswell, Georgia.
There's some pretty ones and there's some ugly ones. And the ugly ones, you ain't going to get any prettier. I hate to tell you. My name is Bill Sanders and I am an alcoholic. And by the grace of God, I'm sober tonight, and that's the most important thing that I will share with you. But it is by the grace of a loving God and the tender, loving care of people like you in rooms like this that I haven't had to have a drink since July 26, 1982. And I thank God every day for that. I also need for you to know, especially those of you who are relatively new, that standing before you is a living, breathing, walking, talking miracle. Also, for those of you who are brand new, that's really not a big deal because you're in a room full of them. You know, my miracles start every day when I get up. As my late sponsor used to say, when I got up this morning, brushed my teeth and didn't gag, that was a miracle. I want to thank the committee for inviting me to be here, to my buddy Steve and Lane, who picked me up at the airport. Sam, who fed me last night about three times more than I needed. And to Lane and Pete, who repeated it again this afternoon. Felt like a stuffed flounder up here. It's good to be back in Alabama again. I don't know how many times this is that I've been fortunate enough to be in various parts of Alabama, from Huntsville to Gulf Shores and everywhere in between. And I was thinking about that as I was getting my things packed to go to the airport the other day to come over here. And, you know, most of us drunks have been around any length of time. You know, it's great when you start getting invited back anywhere. You know, I didn't get invitations back to anywhere before, but to get invited back again and again. And, you know, I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about, you know, the fact that people keep asking me to come over and share. And I turned around to my wife and I said, honey, just out of curiosity, how many truly great AA speakers do you think there are? And she looked at me a second and says, I don't know, but there's one less than you think. God love her, she helps keep me humble. I seem to get doses of humility when I need it the most. I had the good fortune about 8 years ago of going to share at Founders Day in Akron, and I'm sitting, if those of you who've been to Founders Day, outside that great big arena, and I was watching as the thousands and thousands and thousands of people kept pouring in, and we're sitting there on that beautiful lawn leading up to the arena, and I'm watching all these people come in, and I'm thinking, all these people are coming in here to hear me. They're coming to hear me. Can you believe that? And just as my ego got just about as high as it could, a little bird flew over and pooped right on my shoulder. I brushed it off, looked up, and said, thank you. I love being with alcoholics. I like me better when I'm with you. Because I found out you folks bring out the best in me. You know, and that's nothing new. I always hung out with drunks. But I like sober ones better. I had something that I had to confess about my early sobriety was the fact that my sponsor didn't know it, but during the first about 2 months of my sobriety, I was leaving my office every day and stopping at my old water hole and going in and sitting down with those guys and having a Coke with them. And couldn't understand why I was uncomfortable. And he found out what I was doing. And I've been taught not to cuss from the podium, so I'm not going to tell you what he said, but I haven't done it since then. And the thing that I came to realize, those close friends, those bosom buddies, those wonderful, wonderful pals of mine, I have been gone now for 19 years, 11 and a half months. Not a single one of them has written. Not one of them has called. And I finally figured out most of them probably don't even know I'm gone yet. I had, as some of you who were over in Gulf Shores a couple of years ago when I shared over there, we had a little alcoholic snafu occurred when my plane landed in Pensacola and I got off the plane. There was nobody there to meet me. And I sat in the airport about 4 hours, and long story about how I finally did get a ride from somebody from the central office in Pensacola to the conference. But as I spent the afternoon in the airport in Pensacola, wonderful experience. Anything you want to know about the Pensacola airport, I can tell you. You just ask. There was only one place that I could get a Coke, and I kept getting thirsty, and it was the bar. And I walked into the bar, and there's this fella sitting at the bar, and I talked to the young lady, and I said, "Get me a Coke," and I got the Coke, walked out, and the guy, of course, when I walked in the first time, he said, "Hey, come on in, have a seat." I said, "That's okay." And I got my Coke, went back out, and sat in the lobby waiting for somebody to show up, and drank that one. About an hour later, an hour and a half later, I went back into there to get another Coke, still thirsty. "Hey, come on in, sit down, have a beer." And I gave him my usual line. I said, "She doesn't have enough." And he said, "Oh, she's got a big cooler back there full. I don't know what you're doing." And I didn't try to explain it to him. And I went back out of the lobby again after about the third hour. I went back in there, and he's still sitting there. And he said, "You lost?" And I said, "No, I'm not lost. I didn't wait for somebody to pick me up at the airport." I said, "How about you? You miss your plane or something?" And the line he said to me, it was to me profound beyond anything that he intended it to be. He said, "No, I don't never go nowhere. I just sit here and drink." And that was the story of my life for the better part of 20 years. I didn't never go nowhere. I just sat there and drank. When I think of all of the hours, the hundreds of hours spent sitting in bars, the world going by, good things happening in people's lives, enjoying life, and I sat in a bar, not going nowhere, just sitting there drinking. I'm grateful not to be in that trap anymore. I am thankful for the love and the joy and the happiness that you've shown me in this fellowship, that I no longer have to live that way. But it didn't start that way. It didn't start that way at all. When I, you know, had my first drink at the age of 15, and by the way, I need to say this, When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I firmly believed that I had been an alcoholic for about 6 months before I got here. I had some good denial going, folks. I was convinced that I had contracted alcoholism sometime in the last 6 months. You know, there's a funny thing about it. As those of you who have been around for a while know, the longer you stay, it sort of creeps back on you. And I can tell you that I believe at the bottom of my heart that I came into this world an alcoholic. I think I came down the chute with the disease firmly in place. At the age of 15, I put booze into the equation and became a drunk. So today, how long have I been an alcoholic? The whole trip. And the reason I say that is I realize today that the ism of my disease was there from day one. From the very earliest memory that I have, I felt different. I felt apart from. I felt as though I just didn't quite fit in. that I didn't belong. Now, you could ask the kids that I went to high school with, and they'd say, that's ridiculous. Billy Sanders was a member of everything under the sun. That's true. Joined everything. School, scouts, church, you name it, I joined it, belonged to nothing. Because nothing was ever enough, and I never felt that I was a part of it. I felt they knew something that I didn't know. They had something that I didn't have. And if I could ever find out what it that they have was, I'd be okay. So at the very earliest age I remember, long before I had a drink, I began my search for it. Now that's hard when you don't know what it is, and you don't know where to look. So I looked everywhere there was to look. And in the course of my journey, you will see that my search for it took me into a lot of places, down a lot of roads, and into a lot of hell on earth. I was a shy kid. I used to, somebody come up and say hello to me, and I would start staring at my feet and never make eye contact with anybody. At the age of 15, though, that all happened, changed, and I won't go into a lot of the details because every one of us at some place, sometime, somewhere, somehow went through that instant moment of realization of the power of alcohol. Mine happened to have occurred on the banks of the Savannah River separating Georgia and South Carolina. They say that you ought to go back sometime and just sit and meditate at the place you had your first drink. I can't do that. Where I had my first drink is now 300 feet at the bottom of Lake Hartwell. But I get close. But a group of friends had said, you want to go have some beer with us? And I said, sure. Curiosity, peer pressure, whatever it was. And someone sitting on the banks of that river that night popped open a Pabst Blue Ribbon, handed it to me, and I took a great, big, huge slug of it. And I still remember it. It was the most god-awful tasting stuff I'd ever put in my mouth. I thought I was going to throw up. Well, what in the world you see in this stuff? But was I going to let them know that? No. It tasted awful. That's probably why I didn't drink but six that night. But that night, somewhere between the second and the third beer, something happened that all of you know without me telling you. That moment when your entire being changes. That moment when, well, at least for this alcoholic, I became smarter and handsomer and funnier and sexier than I had ever been in my whole life. Well, for that matter, anybody I'd ever known in my whole life. And in that moment, I thought, you know what? I have found a friend that's going to be my friend for the rest of my life. And tragically, it almost was. You see, a lot of things happened that night that I was unaware that was happening. A set of beliefs, a set of beliefs about alcohol were put into motion that I didn't know were wrong until I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And because of that, I went through life and there were whole bunches of people that I flat out did not understand, didn't want to be around them and thought they were crazy. People like the guy that would say, nope, one's my limit. Isn't that the craziest thing you ever heard in your life? Any of y'all ever had one of anything? You know, my philosophy's always been anything worth doing is worth overdoing. Or even worse than that, hear somebody at a party say, whoop, nope, 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 no more for me. I'm beginning to feel it. That's not when you stop. That's when you get started good. Didn't understand those people. And I'll be honest with you, to this day, I don't understand those people. I was just, less than 2 weeks ago, sitting in a restaurant in downtown Atlanta on a business luncheon. And I happened to look, and a couple of guys came and sat down at the next table. One of them ordered, I don't know, bourbon and something. The other one ordered a martini. Anybody brought it, and they set it there, and he diddled around with it with his finger for about 10 minutes. He took 3 or 4 sips of it. Then they ordered lunch and ate it. He took about 3 more sips of that martini and got up and left. Now, folks, I've been sober almost 20 years, but there was a part of me that wanted to get up and chase him out into that parking lot and say, get back in there and finish that drink and order another one. I don't understand those people. And you know what? They don't understand me either. And they're not ever going to understand me. And I've quit trying to make them understand me. Because I found some people who do. I didn't drink that much in high school because I grew up in a little bitty town in the hills of North Georgia. And any of you who grew up in a small town know that there's one thing you're real short on in small towns, and that's anonymity. Everybody knows everybody else's business. We all knew who the town drunk was. The town drunk in my town, God bless him, was a little old guy named Tom Kaysen. Tom Kaysen slept on the park bench in front of Haley's drugstore. Nobody bothered him. And he'd get up and take out his blanket and all that stuff and put them behind a big potted plant until nighttime. He'd go back there and sleep there again in the wintertime. I don't know where he slept. But Tom, he was unquestionably an alcoholic because he had an old, nasty, filthy trench coat that I don't have any idea what the original color of it was. You know, you could smell him coming around the corner before he ever got to you. And he had yellow tennis shoes because, well, y'all know why they were yellow. And Tom Kaysen, I knew, was our town alcoholic, our Otis Campbell, if you will. And I thought he was the only one. We said, we got a little bitty town, you know. It's not big enough to have more than one alcoholic, I thought. But I also thought, if I don't ever become like Tom Kaysen, then I'll be okay. And I pursued that belief right through the gates of hell and nearly to the gates of death because of those myths that I set up in my head. When I went off to college and I was thrust into a university that was nearly 3 times the population of my whole hometown, I had my first taste of anonymity. Nobody cared how much I drank. Nobody watched over my shoulder. They didn't even care if I went to class or not, so more than often than not, I didn't. I'd like to share with you some of the great memories of my college career. And I would if I could. But by then, I was beginning to suffer from what we in North Georgia, and I imagine y'all do in South Alabama too, refer to as spells. Don't mess with him. He's having one of his spells. I've learned we call them blackouts, but you know. And see, 1961, that was a blackout. And but I do know I stayed in a lot of trouble in college. And I'm going to skip over that because it hurts when I talk about it. But I finally got out of college and I went to work in my chosen profession. I should back up a little bit and tell you that I went into the profession that I have been in all my life and still am today, and that's the broadcasting business. At the age of 13, I became a disc jockey. Hot stuff. And at that time, supposedly the youngest disc jockey in America, I understand that there is that record's been beaten over and over. This young fella up in, I think it's Minnesota, who has his own radio program who's 3 years old. But back then, I was supposed to be the youngest full-time disc jockey in America. And I went and did a rock and roll radio program right after school every afternoon. And everybody assumed that the smart aleck kid behind the microphone spinning records and flapping his yap was who I was. They did not know that was the same scared, terrified little boy hiding behind the anonymity of a microphone in a darkened studio where nobody could see. They didn't know that my search for it was going on. They never had a clue about how afraid I was, how bewildered I was with life and how to cope with it and how to deal with it. When I got out of college, I went to work in a very prominent radio station just outside of Atlanta. And we had a very simple life. Incidentally, along the way, just as I got out of college, I met a beautiful young girl. And she and I began to date, and I began to think, well, you know, if you want to make her a part of your life, you probably need to cut down on your drinking some. And after about three dates, discovered I didn't need to do any such thing. That woman liked drink just as much as I did. So, just a few months later, we were married, and she became my first wife, and we were up and running. And it was a simple life. I'd get up in the morning, go to work. She'd get up in the morning, go to work. And then when you got up, she'd get off at 5 in the afternoon with her bookkeeping job. And when I'd finish my 6 o'clock newscast at 6:30, I would leave the studio, go home, pick her up, and we'd head to the local club and drink till they closed at 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. And that was a pattern. It just happened over and over and over and over again. And of course, we'd get up the next morning, drag ourselves out of bed, and go to work. Now, most people, you know, if you tied one on the night before, the person at the next desk or across the hall might know it, but see, I had to get up in the morning at 6 o'clock and go in and sign a radio station on the air and be cheerful. Now, if you won't know what hell is, you try being cheerful at 6 o'clock in the morning when your head feels like the Russian army had maneuvers on it the night before and your mouth tastes like the bottom of a birdcage. My radio audiences never knew how many newscasts they heard me do, lying flat on my back on the floor with a microphone pulled out over my face reading the news. The only way I could get the room to quit going zoom, zoom, zoom. Well, I could go into some wild stories of my career, but I will share one that came back to me a few years ago in sobriety. And it happened when I was working at WSB in Atlanta, and the news director came in one day and said, Bill, grab a tape recorder, get the mobile unit, go downtown, you got to go do an interview. Okay, fine, who am I going to interview? Lyndon Johnson. Oh. Well, I got the tape recorder, got in the mobile unit, started downtown to what was then the Dinkler Plaza Hotel to interview, and it occurred to me, there ain't no way I can do this without a little bit of fortification. So I made a quick stop at one of my water holes and had me a couple of quick shooters, jumped back in it, went downtown, got on the elevator, went up to the floor that was designated to me, of course, met at the door by a pair of Secret Service men. They frisked me, checked me, then ushered me down the hall, you know, after going through my credentials and all of that, and threw the door into this suite, and I was greeted by this giant of a man who stuck his big old hand out and grabbed mine and said, come on in, boy, and sit down. I sat down on a sofa facing another sofa that he was on, and between us was a big old round coffee table, and sitting in the middle of that coffee table was a tray with some ice and a couple of glasses and a bottle of Jack Daniels. He said, before we do this interview here, why don't we have us a little bourbon? Sounded good to me. So he poured my glass. He didn't bother with the ice. He poured my glass full and poured his glass full. And we started talking. Now, in those days, and I should have to explain this, in those days, you didn't just walk in and interview the President of the United States. You had to do what was known as the pre-interview interview. And that's where you tell him what you're going to ask him, and he'll tell you whether he was going to answer it or not. Politicians don't get away with that today, but they used to, especially in Johnson's era. As we went through talking and talking and talking, every time I'd take about 4 swallows out of that glass, he'd fill it back up again. Started getting hot in there. And we talked on, I have no idea how long, and we're going back and forth. Of course, he's interrupting the questions to tell me about his dogs and all this stuff. And suddenly it hit me. Dear God, this man is drunker than you are. A couple of minutes after that, he says, all right, let's do it. And when he was ready to go, he was ready to go. Turn that thing on. I turned on the tape recorder. We started the interview. And I have to tell you, the interview went great. It went great. I asked great questions. He gave great answers. You'd never have known. Until I got to the point where I asked him a question about his wife, Ladybug. I'm just grateful he thought it was funnier than y'all did. that's an example of my journey through my career. There are a lot more, and we're going to skip them. In the early 70s, my wife and I, by now, are full-blown, I know today, full-blown alcoholics. We're spending all of our time and most of our money drinking. And there was a pause in there because in 1970, my wife gave birth to a beautiful, absolutely gorgeous little blue-eyed, blonde-haired girl. Beautiful little princess. When she was born, I said, you know, we need to clean up our act and get to be good parents. And we did. We cleaned up our act. We became model parents, doing 2 a.m. feedings, changing diapers, making formula, doing all that great stuff. We were model parents for, 3-4 weeks. And then we discovered the great American institution of the babysitter, and we were off and running again. Now, I hear people say in this fellowship, when they talk about their marriages that didn't make it, that their biggest problem was a problem of communication. And I'm sorry, I can't really relate to that, because I can tell you, my wife and I communicated. We always did. I mean, as a matter of fact, you could ask our neighbors 3 or 4 doors down the street, and they'd tell you the Sanders communicate. They could probably even tell you what we were communicating about. And our communications sessions were usually pretty simple. I could hang in there with the best of them until it became apparent that I was on the losing end of the discussion. And then, of course, I'd go to Plan B. Now, all you men know what Plan B is. You grab your bottle, you storm out the back door and slam it, and you get in the car and you peel out of the driveway and you go heading out up the street saying, I don't need to stay here and listen to this crap. Happened over and over and over. I see some heads nodding out there, and it ain't the men that are nodding. See, guys, we were in blackouts, remember? We don't remember some of that stuff. They do. Those Al-Anons. And that happened over and over and over and over again. One Sunday afternoon, we were ready to launch into a discussion, and I had all my dates, facts, places, numbers all lined up, ready to go. No way I could lose this one. No way in the world. 10 minutes in, Plan B. Grabbed my bottle, stormed out the back door, jumped in the car, peeled up the driveway, headed out of here, just like 100 other times. Only one difference this time, I still had my pajamas on. Well, my wife did what any sweet, caring, loving wife would do. She sent a friend to come get me and bring me home. The only thing wrong with that is that friend happened to be a police captain. And he found me sitting in the parking lot of the Holiday Inn, absolutely minding my own business, sitting there talking to my bottle. He came up and rapped on the window. I looked up. Hey, Harold. He suggested I get out of my car and get in the squad car with him. And I told him that he could... I told him, no, thank you. Now, clean that up all right, Steve? Okay. Then he began to talk to me about his relative size to mine and about his Marine Corps wrestling medals he'd won and about the size of that billy club hanging on his belt. And, you know, it began to make sense. I might want to think about going with him. I was drunk. I wasn't stupid. I also wasn't so drunk that I knew in about 2 turns we weren't heading toward my house. About 2 more turns I knew where we were headed because he pulled into the emergency room parking lot of the local hospital. And before I could issue 1 single word of protest, he had me out of that squad car, into that hospital, checked in, upstairs, in a bed, flat out, bam, just like that. You wouldn't believe how fast you can get checked in the hospital when you already got your pajamas on. They mumble something about public relations, you know. This guy with a scotch bottle under his arm sitting in the lobby, it just don't look good, you know. Nearly 3 weeks later, checked out of that hospital. Learned anything? No. Drunk before the sun went down. Then it was time for the great American alcoholic geographical cure, and we moved back to Atlanta. And people ask me, you know, where have you lived in Atlanta? I said, all over the place. We moved to Stone Mountain, then to Sandy Springs, then to Forest Park, then back to... You know, if somebody had told me that thing that I've heard 1,000 times around AA, it'd have saved me a lot of money if I had just known that no matter where I go, there I am. Because I always thought somehow I was going to escape. And I never did. I got involved in a part of the business that I have been in since then, and it involved, among other things, something called public relations. And the interesting thing about that was I didn't even know what public relations was. And I came from a little bitty town in North Georgia. People didn't have relations in public. And I still don't understand a lot of it. I've been doing it for 27 years. One of the things I did like, though, is I was introduced to a thing called a three-martini lunch. Now, I like five better, but if three was your number, that was all right. And I liked another thing they had that I never had heard of anywhere else I'd lived. They had it in Atlanta called a happy hour. And that's where you go in, sit down, and order a drink and pay for it, and they bring you two. Sometimes three. And it didn't take me long. I'm a smart boy. Remember, I went to college. And it didn't take me long to figure out if you stretch those five martini lunches a little later and you go to the happy hour a little earlier, you can kind of book the two together and not even go back to work in the afternoon. I need to tell you that by now my disease, alcoholism, had outfitted me something that I was unaware of. And that's a set of blinders. Those blinders that don't allow you to see things. For example, when I would come back from one of those, if I did come back to the office after one of those five or six martini lunches, those blinders did not allow me to see that my staff wasn't happy. Because while the guy who came in the morning was capable of being a reasonably nice guy, the one who came back from one of those long liquid lunches was not a nice person. He was judgmental, forgetful, argumentative, and at times downright mean. But those blinders didn't allow me to see that. Even more importantly, those blinders did not allow me to see that my beautiful little blue-eyed blonde-haired girl, who by now is 6, 7, 8 years old, doesn't invite friends over to spend the night. She never knows when Dad's going to come home in the middle of the night in a drunken rage, smashing furniture, screaming, yelling, calling her names, belittling her. Those blinders didn't allow me to see that the only look that was ever in that little girl's eyes was fear and hate and disgust. Those blinders were powerful. But you see, I was still on my quest for it, and that was all that was important. And I searched for it in high places and low. I thought at one time that if I made enough money, that whatever it was, I could buy it. And at various times in my career, I made a lot of money. But the money wasn't it. And I still didn't know what it was so that I could go buy it. I thought for a while that it was in women. And I was as unfaithful as anybody could be in their marriage. That was not it. I thought for a while that, you know, if you had enough stuff, that would be it. So I go out and buy stuff. You know what I mean. You know, cars and televisions and VCRs and, you know, if you got enough stuff, then that'll be it. Wasn't it. If you all need some stuff, I got a garage full, so come on up. All kinds of stuff. That was not it. I was a traveling drunk. I think I thought that if I went enough places that I could find it wherever it was somewhere else. That didn't work either. I had to travel a good bit in my business, and I would do. Always leave from the airport early, get out there and, you know, have a few drinks before I get on the plane. Never have like flying all that much, and so I need to get a little bit fortified before I would get on the plane. So I'd go out to the airport and go in the bar and sit down and have a few drinks. That's all right, unless you forget to get on the plane. Y'all remember those commercials that Delta had a few years ago? Ironically, I even did a couple of those commercials that said, "Delta is ready when you are." Hey, lad, they'll go off and leave you. So I did what any good drunk would do. I just get on another plane and go somewhere else. Call home that night. Wife says, how's the convention in New York? Oh, no, no, I'm not in New York. Where are you? I'm in New Orleans. You know how I knew I was in New Orleans? Because I opened the nightstand drawer of that dumpy little motel I was in, and right there on the front of the phone book said New Orleans. That's the only way I knew where I was. More and more often, strange places, strange beds, strange people. All of this time searching, searching, searching for it. All of this time trying to find companionship. Yet I was somehow always lonely. I could be in a crowd twice this size and still feel so alone. So, you people know the feeling. I believe the loneliest lonely on the face of this earth is the loneliness of an alcoholic buried in the mire of his or her disease. I hope I never feel that again. Used to drinking, at least in the business world, in classy places. And I need to say that in the business world, because that was in the daytime. I drink in classy places where you walk in and the maitre d' would meet me at the door in his tuxedo and his funny little Portuguese accent or whatever it was. Good evening, good afternoon, Mr. Santa. Welcome. Come in. Your table right over there, and the bar is over there, and I knew where the bar was. But I'd head toward the bar, and as soon as I would walk through the doors of the bartender started mixing, set the drink up on the bar right in front of my usual stool without me even having to ask for it. And I used to take people in there with me so they could see that. Because I knew that made a statement. What a statement I thought it was making, but it was making a statement all right. And you know, these were classy places with the deep pile carpets and the big thick leather bar rails, and everybody had a tuxedo on and all that. And, you know, this is classy. I was even a drinking snob. I would tell you the optimum temperature for drinking vodka is 31.5 degrees Fahrenheit. Found out later that wasn't true at all. The optimum temperature for drinking vodka is 108 degrees. Because that was the temperature underneath the front seat of my car where I kept the bottle hid. I thought it was classy. But I'm going to tell you something, people. For you newcomers, you know, class has a way of being elusive. Because when you wake up in the morning and you look down and there's dew all over your clothes, and you blink your eyes and realize you're looking out from underneath a bush in a downtown Atlanta City Park up the nostrils of a policeman's horse, there is no way to make that classy. There's also no good to the question of what are you doing here? All I can say is, where's here? There is no class when you plant your car into a steel post on the side of an Atlanta City street and the cop comes and peels you out of the car, literally. Takes you over, frisks you, handcuffs you, and puts you in the cage in the back of the car and takes you off toward the station. The whole time I'm telling him, officer, there is no way I'm drunk. No possible way in the world, and had but two beers. I'm convinced, y'all may disagree with it, I'm convinced that there is a school somewhere. Now listen to me. That there's a school somewhere that they take us when we're in a blackout so we don't remember it. And they tell you, if you ever stop at the cops, never admit to more than two beers. You ever watch these cop shows on TV? I mean, they're falling down on the two beers. Anyway, I told him I had but two beers. He got me to the police station, dragged me out of the back of that thing, took me in there, leaned me up against that counter, stuck that thing in my mouth and said, blow. Registered .28. I told him, I said, now wait just a minute. There is no way in the world that is absolutely impossible to be registered .28 on two beers. He agreed with me. But That was the only thing we agreed on that night. That's not classy, folks. And for those of you who are not finished with your stories yet, let me give you a little piece of advice. When you get a DUI, don't go to court drunk. Judges don't like it. And it cost me. Back then, you kind of got a freebie in Georgia. I don't know how it was in Alabama. You don't get them anymore, but you got kind of a freebie that if this was your first one, and it was, you could go in and you could enter a plea of no contest, or the words nolo contendere, and they basically would give you like a $500 fine, slap on the wrist, and send you home. As drunk as I was, there is no way on earth I could say nolo contendere. I stood there, guilty, whole 9 yards, lost my license for a year and fine and the whole bit. My wife no longer asked where I was when I didn't come home for 2, 3, 4 days in a row. My daughter was relieved when I didn't come home 3 or 4 days in a row. I was putting a new mattress on my daughter's bed one time and discovered a little book there, and it said diary, and as I shouldn't have done, I opened it, and the words jumped off of the page, "I wish my daddy was dead, and maybe there would be some peace at home." But you see, the blinders were firmly in place. As I said, my wife no longer cared where the other went or what the other did. And many nights she would be off in her bars drinking, and I would be off in my bars drinking. And home alone in an apartment in a big city is a beautiful little blue-eyed, blonde-haired girl, by now nearly 12 years old. Alone. Scared. Calling bar phones from memory. Is my mom there? Is my dad there? The phone would ring and the bartender would answer it and turn and say, "It's your kid," and hand me the phone. A trembling little voice on the other end would say, "Daddy, please come home. I'm scared. Where's your mom?" "I don't know, Daddy. Please come home." Many drinks later, I would stumble into that apartment. There, cowering in the corner of the bed, sat that little girl, tears streaming down her face. But the blinders were firmly in place. I didn't ask where my wife was going when she left one night, and I was sitting in my recliner chair staring at the television set nursing my bottle. She left and was gone about 3 hours, and she came back in. I'm still sitting in that recliner chair, still nursing that bottle, still staring at that television set, and probably trying to decide whether to turn it on or not. And my wife came and stood in front of me and said, "Guess where I've been?" And I said, who really cares? And she didn't say anything. She did something really, really weird. She flipped a white poker chip into my lap. And I looked down at it, and I looked back at her, and I looked back at it, and I said, "I don't know where you've been, but if I saw you won, you had a lousy night." Then I happened to notice that little chip had two little A's on it. And she told me where she'd been. She'd been to an A&A meeting. And I went into a flying, pluperfect rage because I knew beyond any shadow of a doubt that there was no way on the face of this earth that that woman was an alcoholic. She was an alcoholic. She just couldn't be an alcoholic. That's all there was to it. I mean, she didn't care about what I thought. She started going to meetings and going to meetings and going to meetings and going to meetings and going to meetings. Some fool nonsense about 90, 90, and 90-something. And I kept waiting for the other shoe to fall. I kept waiting for her to say, "You need this worse than I do. You're a bigger drunk." Didn't do it. None of that. Oh,
She left little clues around the house, like I'd go in and lift the toilet seat, and there's "How It Works" taped to the lid. Finally, the other shoe did fall. She came home one day and said, "I'm going tonight to pick up a 90-day chip, and I'd like you to be there." "No way, Jose. Not this boy. Forget it. No how." Few tears, few pleas, few deals. And I said, "Okay, fine, on one condition. I'm going in my car." I said, "Where are we going?" She said, "We're going to a place called 8111 Club. Follow me." And I got in my car and drove just a few miles from my house down on Roswell Road in Atlanta. And she turned in the driveway of this little house sitting up on the hill in a grove of trees, pretty little house up there. And it was a house they had converted into an AA clubhouse. And I had a weird feeling when I turned up that driveway, because I'd passed that place 1,000 times. And every time on the way home from the bar, and every time I'd look up there, I'd say, "You know, you ought to get to know the guy that lives in that house, because he obviously has a party every night." Well, that night old Bill went to the party. I slipped down behind a post in the back of the room in that place, and for the next hour I witnessed the biggest bunch of weirdos I'd ever seen in my life. They read all that stuff at the beginning of the meeting. I don't remember any of it. And then this one guy starts waving his hand, doing like that. And I went, "My God, somebody tell him to go on to the bathroom and get him." They pointed to him. He stood up right in front of that whole crowd of people. He said his name and that he was an alcoholic. And just as I'm saying, "I don't think I'd have told that if I'd have been him," he told him he had gotten 3 DUIs. And you know what they did? They busted out laughing. It's a sick bunch of people. I didn't get it. Because what was going through my head is, what are these people laughing for? Don't they know who they are? They're alcoholics. They ain't got anything to laugh about. I remember that thought. And I want to remember that, because I'm going to tell you something, folks. I thank God every day of my life for the laughter that we share in these rooms. Because there's magic and there's power and there's healing in that laughter. And wherever I go, I say, if you don't have a home group that laughs a lot, go find one that does. I also like to tell the newcomers, don't laugh all the time or they'll come get you. This meeting went on. The next guy raised his hand and said he'd gotten 5 DUIs and was arrested for indecent exposure. Those people came unglued. I'm sitting there thinking, good God, if they knew some of the stuff that happened to me, I'd sound like Richard Pryor. Meeting went on, seemed like forever, and finally everybody stood up and grabbed hands and said the only thing familiar to me that hour, and that was the Lord's Prayer, and then I headed out the door across the parking lot to get out of that place as fast as I could. And I got about 2/3 away across the parking lot, and something grabbed me by the shoulder. It felt like a steel vise. Spun me around, and I found myself looking up into the face of a man 7 feet, 11 inches tall. I know tonight he's only 6'6", but he looked a lot taller that night. I remembered him from the meeting, too. He was a little different from the rest of them. The rest of them said, "My name's Joe, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Mary, I'm an alcoholic. My name is..." This guy was different. When they called on him, he stood up and said, "My name's Floyd, and I'm a grateful hillbilly drunk." Give me a break. This guy started talking to me about drinking moonshine up in the mountains, and about his 5th grade education, and about his DUI he got driving a school bus. And I'm thinking, why is he telling me all this? The guy don't even know who I am. I found out later he knew exactly who I was, because she'd been talking about me in those meetings. People came out and got in their cars and left. You know, now, I mean, I went in my own car now so I can get out of here. My wife comes out and goes, bye, gets in her car and leaves. And it's me and Floyd. And he starts telling me about getting drunk out in the woods in the wintertime and falling down on the ground and his face freezing to the ground. And they had to pour coffee on him to get him up. Of course, I'm not hearing most of this. I'm busy making a deal with God. Floyd talked on there, I don't know, 3-4 days. I finally got away from him, got in my car, went home, walked in the house. My wife started to say something. I said, don't open your mouth. Don't you ever try to get me back to that nut bin again. And she didn't. And the roller coaster ride continued. And the pain got worse. And the loneliness got worse. And the search for it was over. On the afternoon of July 26, 1982, I came out of a week-long blackout drunk. Whole week missing. And when I came out of the blackout, I'm sitting in a recliner chair, and in my left hand is an empty bottle, and in my right hand is a fully loaded and cocked .22 pistol, and I don't remember picking up either one of them. And the thought going through my head was, is this all there is? Is this really all there is? Because if it is, you can have it. And through the fog of that twilight time on a Monday afternoon, I heard a voice. The voice of God? Not exactly. Voice of an angel? Not quite. It was the voice of a beautiful, wonderful, lovable, strapping, hillbilly drunk named Floyd. Now, folks, I would have thought God would have at least sent me a PhD. I was always looking for a messenger, but I wasn't looking for Floyd. Through that foggy afternoon, the words that cut through my soul were simply this. I remembered that Floyd had said, when I come to AA, I expected God to open the gates of heaven and let me in. He didn't. But he opened the gates of hell and let me out. And where I was on the afternoon of July 26, 1982 is closer to hell on this earth. I pray that I never know it. And I got up out of my chair and I went into the bathroom and I cleaned up as best I could and I gargled about a half a bottle of Listerine, drank the rest. And then I went back and got in my car and drove back to that little house on the hill and sat down in the back of the room behind that post and peeked around at the front. Now, I don't know about the God of your understanding, but the God of my understanding has a sense of humor, and I'll tell you just how much before we're through tonight. I looked around the front of the room, sitting there chairing the meeting, sat my wife. She didn't see me till the end of the meeting, till the guy got up and explained those chips, and I heard surrender, and I heard pain, and I heard freedom, and some other words. And I got out of that chair, and I took the longest walk I have ever taken in my life to the front of that room. And a man pressed that white poker chip into my trembling, sweating palm, and I closed around and walked back and sat down. I choose to believe with all my heart that an old Bill Sanders went to the front of that room that night and died, and that a new one walked away because by the grace of God, the tender, loving care of people like you in rooms like this, I haven't taken a drink since that moment. You told me very early in sobriety I needed to get a sponsor. I thought, no problem. I'm in broadcasting. I got lots of sponsors. Take your pick. He explained what kind of sponsor you were talking about. And I said, oh. And I decided to do that scientifically. I looked around for the sweetest, kindest, roly-poliest, white-haired old granddaddy I could find. One that I knew would pat me on the head on a daily basis and said, don't change a thing about the way you're doing this program. I've never seen anybody doing it better than you, and I wouldn't change a thing. Took about 3 or 4 weeks, and I found him.
roly-poly than I am, snow white hair, big old smile a mile wide, plastered on his face every time you saw him, and I asked a man named Doc Crandall to be my sponsor. That's the biggest mistake I ever made in my life. I knew I was in trouble that very first day. I said, when I would be my sponsor, he said, sure, let's discuss the rules. Rules? What rules? Oh, they're nothing very complicated. Every morning you roll out of bed, you're going to roll out first onto your knees, and you're going to ask the God of your understanding to keep you sober today. And the last thing you're going to do at night is to get back down there, and you're going to say thank you. Well, now, Doc, I grew up in Southern Baptist Church, and when I was a kid, the church doors opened, we were there, and I know praying's important. We close and open every meeting with the pastor, but I just got to be honest with you. I'm not comfortable with this knee business. He said, I didn't say a damn thing about you being comfortable. And then I got real cocky and said, Doc, I thought this was a program of suggestion. He says, it is. I suggest you do it or get you another sponsor. And that's how we started our relationship. And it went downhill from there. He gave me that book. Told me to take that home and read, study, not read the first 164 pages. And then come back and sit down and say, we're going to talk about how you can make it work in your life. Now, I didn't realize at that point what I was getting into. This guy was a nutcase about that book. I mean, he was a lunatic about that thing. Didn't realize it then. I said, yeah, I can do that. And I went home and I got the book down and I opened it up and I started, of course, I stopped by the office supply place and got me some highlighters and pencils and a couple of legal pads. And I started highlighting, I started underlining, and I struck through the steps that didn't have anything to do with me. And I jotted down a few I'd thought of that y'all hadn't. And after about 3 weeks, I called him. I said, Doc, I'm ready to talk. He said, hot dog, come on over here. I went over to his house, and we spread everything out on the coffee table, and he read back in his big old recliner chair and said, all right, boy, lay it on me. I flipped the book open, and I got my notes all set, and I flipped that book over to chapter 5 and pointed down there. So, okay, Doc, look in here, step 1. As I interpret, and that's as far as I got. Boy, that step don't need your interpreting. It needs your doing. Yeah, but Doc, what I think it means is, he said, son, look at it real close. It's in English. It says what it means. And if you look even closer, you'll notice they put numbers by those steps so smart college boys like you can follow along. God, he was tough. And as I said, he was a nutcase about that book. I had a personnel problem at work one day, and I called him, and I said, Doc, I need to talk to you. Can I get to the meeting early? He said, come on. Got to the meeting early, grabbed a cup of coffee, went out under a tree off the parking lot, and I said, I got this personnel problem at work. Let me lay it on you and see what you've had a lot more experience than I have. He said, hold it, whoop, before you get started, let me ask you a question. I said, what? He said, what step are you using on this? I said, this ain't got nothing to do with steps. I'm talking about some real life stuff here. He said, go look again. I went home, I got the book down, I opened it up, went through, down through the steps. There wasn't a blasted thing about personnel problems. I went back the next night, I said, Doc, I looked in the book, and I went down through those steps. There wasn't anything pertaining to what I was talking about. Let me lay out this situation. Go look again. I'm driving home thinking, God, that crazy old bastard. How'd I get stuck with him? And I got the book down, I went back, back. There was the answer. Over and over and over and over again, he kept sending me back to that book and back to those steps until finally, the little bell went off in the back of this hard, feeble brain of mine that there is nothing. There is nothing. There is nothing that is going to happen in the life of this alcoholic that the answer is in that book and is in those steps. And you will never persuade me otherwise. I happen now to believe, I've come to believe that that is a magic book. We're making a big whoop-de-doo about the fact that we got the fourth edition right now. I'm ahead of you because I'm reading the 26th edition right now. I am. Because I've read that book from cover to cover 26 times, and every time I read it, they've rewritten that sucker. I'm not kidding, people. You're laughing at me. The reason I know, you see, I told you I'm a highlighter and an underliner. And I'm going through the book and reading something, all of a sudden I go, wow, look at that. That wasn't in here the last time I read it. It hadn't been highlighted. Now, there's something over here highlighted. I don't know who did that. That ain't no big deal. But this, look at that. I told that in a thing out in Southern California. And this young lady came up to me after the thing was over. And she said, do you really believe that? And I told her what I now shared, that I do know. And I do believe with all my heart that God reveals himself to me through this book when I am capable of seeing it and when I need the words. And it occurs to me that if I don't pick this book up and read it, I may miss a message that God has for me. The same goes for going to meetings. I remember my sponsor saying, boy, you missed a great meeting last night. That was a powerful meeting. Man, I heard something last night, that meeting I am never going to forget. So what? He said, I don't know what you're supposed to hear. I heard what I was supposed to hear. You missed what you were supposed to hear. I asked him one time, do you think maybe God speaks to us through people? He said, who do you think he speaks through, Frisbees? So I pray for God's will, and then I go to a meeting and find out what it is. And now I've gotten to be one of those fanatical nuts about that book. As some of you know who have heard me share before, on November 25th, 1985, my sponsor Doc went on a 12-step call and never came home. As he and another man struggled to take a shotgun away from a suicidal young man that Doc had been trying to help get sober, the shotgun discharged. Doc caught the blast full in the stomach and died before he reached the hospital. That evening I sat at his home and I felt a loneliness come over me I hadn't felt in a long time. And all I could think of was, how can I go on? How can I stay sober without the man who planted me in this program, who planted me in these steps, who kicked my behind when I needed it, who put his arms around my shoulder when I needed it? How can I go on? And in the stillness of that evening, the answer came. You'll do it by doing the things he taught you to do, and that his sponsor taught him and his sponsor before him taught him, all the way back to that fateful night in the spring of 1935 when the broken down stockbroker and the has-been doctor sat in that gatehouse in Akron and said, do you think we might stay sober if we help one another? From that day to this, I can tell you, I've been surrounded by the greatest little bunch of snot-nosed sponsees anybody could ever have. Right after Doc's death, they gathered around me, and they pestered the daylights out of me. They dragged me to meetings when I didn't want to go. They were banging on my door at all hours of the day and night, wanting me to share when I wanted to isolate. And they loved me, and they cared for me until I could walk the walk again. And I love them for it. Now, I went for a year and a half after Doc's death, and I'm not proud of this, not at all. I went for a little over a year and a half, sponsoring myself. Except for and I'd be drunk if it hadn't been for those sponsees. You people that have never done it, when you sponsor yourself, you got a fool for a sponsor and a bigger fool for a sponsee. I ended up getting another sponsor, and I won't go through the long story of how, with God's sense of humor, I ended up with him, but I ended up with a sponsor by the name of Dr. Paul O. Many of you know him as the Dr. Alcoholic Addict in the other edition of the big book, now on whatever page he's on in the new one. And he was my sponsor for the last 10 years of his life. And I learned a lot about acceptance and about a lot of other things from that beautiful, wonderful man and from his sweet wife, Max. I did get to do one thing that I can't resist sharing that you've got to know about. I got to do something that none of you have ever gotten to do. See, my sponsor made me read those infamous pages over and over and over and over again because of what he called my other disease of terminal uniqueness. And that's one reason I didn't like Paul from before I ever met him. But one day, he and I had a unique sponsorship. We talked back and forth on the phone a couple of times a week. We saw each other at conferences like this about four or five times a year, but we emailed back and forth every day. Now, I'm going to warn you, if you've got an email relationship with a sponsor, be careful what you say, because he might say those suckers and run them back at you later. I had that happen. But one day he called me, and I answered the phone. I said, "Oh, hey, Paul, how you doing?" He said, "You don't want to know." I said, "What's going on?" He said, "Well, they're recarpeting the whole house. They put new linoleum in the kitchen. Max is in there cussing them out and telling them it's the wrong color. My computer, the reason I didn't email you this morning, is sitting out in the middle of the floor. They've unplugged everything, and I can't even get to it. Sabrina, their little dog who happened to be blind, is going around the house bumping into everything because nothing's where it's supposed to be. And he's telling me all this, and it's going through my head, Bill, don't miss this chance." And out of my mouth the words came, "Maybe you need to go read page 449. It felt good. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm going to close it now. I need to clear up a couple of things. Number one, I have found it. It took me a long time, but I did. And I found it completely by accident. I was sitting in a meeting one day, and somebody was reading How It Works. And they were reading along, and I was half paying attention like we tend to do in a meeting. And he said, "If you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, it's been here all along. It's been in these rooms all along. You've had it. We've had it all along. We don't need to search anymore. We don't need to go back out there. It's all in here." I refer to the woman I married in 1966 as my first wife, because you see, I'm not married to the same woman, and thank God she's not married to the same man. We're the same bodies, but we are not the same people. You change that. A few years ago, I walked down the aisle with my little girl and delivered her hand into the hand of another man. And it's just before we went down the aisle, I looked into her eyes, and instead of fear and hate and disgust, I saw love and I saw respect. At the reception, my daughter had said, "I'm going to have my first dance with Paul, her new husband, but I'm going to have the second dance with you." And some of you have heard me share before, I told her, "Honey, tell me what we're going to dance to so I can practice a little bit with your mom, because I don't dance near as well today as I never did." And she wouldn't tell me, and as she led me out onto the dance floor, the music began, and the words were, "Did you ever know that you're my hero and everything I want to be? I can fly higher than an eagle. You're the wind beneath my wings." Dear God, what a miracle had been worked in the lives of this family that had been ripped and shredded and torn apart by the insidious, unforgiving, unrelenting disease called alcoholism. And yet, meeting by meeting, sponsor by sponsor, prayer by prayer, step by step, you, God, and AA put this family back together again. Three days ago, I went with my daughter to a doctor's office. And as he put a stethoscope over her, I heard the heartbeat of my grandson, who's due in less than 3 weeks. And all I could think of was, I almost missed this. And my daughter looked up and said, "Daddy, you're going to be a good granddaddy." I can tell you there's no high I ever had out of any bottle, pill, or anything else that could match what I felt at that moment. I am tonight where I'd rather be than any place on the face of this earth, and that's in a room full of drunks who know who and what I am, who all I have to say is my name is Bill and I'm an alcoholic, and you know everything you need to know. So it couldn't come as a surprise to you that I would conclude tonight by saying, did you ever know that you are my heroes? You're everything I've ever searched for, dreamed about, and wanted to be. And I believe with all of my heart that together, we can all soar like eagles, because he's the wind beneath our wings. God bless you, and thank you very much.